Thank you so much for bearing with me on this.
No, man. Thank you. Are you insane? It's okay, supposed to give me a chance to express myself. What are you saying?
All right. Here we go. And hello and welcome to Colonial Outcasts, a podcast that focuses on the destructive and self-destructive nature of empire and imperialism, amongst other things. Here, we like to open on action, so we are now all acquainted with this absurd humanitarian aid port in Gaza idea, you know, that it will take months to construct, which is absurd because I have many Navy CB friends, CB stands for Construction Battalion, who say they could construct a temporary port in no time, unless, of course, they don't want the port to be temporary, which would require a more intensive construction process. So people have been talking about the natural gas reserves and the Gaza Marine Base, and they've also been talking about how it could be used to forcibly relocate people from the Gaza Strip. And we're going to touch on these things in this episode, but our main focus today is going to be on the strategically vital island of Cyprus. As a side note, if you ever wonder as a layperson if a place is strategically important, just look to see if there are any NATO or US or British bases on it, and you'll have your answer. Also, Israel is apparently purchasing a port in Cyprus, and in this episode, we're really going to get into the weeds of the Western imperialism happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. To help us do this, we are joined by Elena Xenofontos, an international law and globalization specialist. She has worked as a researcher in international and EU policy throughout Europe with a special focus on financial and corporate crime. A lot of her work is centered on the geopolitical analysis of policy and the economic underpinning of EU foreign policy objectives. She has worked with organizations such as SOMO, the Center for Research on Multinational Corporations based in the Netherlands. Also, she's from Cyprus, so this all works out. Thanks so much for coming on, Alina.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg.
All right. Yeah, and we're talking about Cyprus within the context of what's happening in Palestine, i.e. the British airstrikes being launched from Cyprus onto targets in Yemen, how Israel has just purchased a port there ostensibly to oversee and inspect aid in Gaza. We first got into contact because I was talking about the buffer zone being constructed in Egypt adjacent to Gaza, and I mentioned reductively the buffer zone between Turkish Cyprus and Greek Cyprus. And I think before we get into the thickets here, perhaps you can just give us some context about the political situation in Cyprus, the idea of a unitary state, and the relationship with Israel. So I'm going to briefly play a video you just sent me from Cypriot activists, and you can just jump right in. So I'm going to pull that up right now. It's like a minute and a half. And hopefully we don't have any tech issues.
The government of Cyprus says that it is not involved in the US and British airstrikes against Yemen. But these British strikes are coming from fighter jets taken off from UK bases within the island of Cyprus.
The people of Cyprus demand an end to the aggression against Yemen, whose only crime has been international solidarity with the people of Palestine, struggling against a US-backed Zionist genocide by halting the supply of weapons and goods to the occupation state of Israel. But how can the nation of Cyprus be considered independent if the people have no say over how the UK and other NATO members use our country for their own gain?
Cypriots fought for their independence from British colonial rule. However, when the Cypriot state was established in 1960, the United Kingdom managed to retain its military bases on the island, employing divide and rule tactics within Cypriot society. Today, the UK continues to treat our island as if it were still a colony, being directly involved in airstrikes against the Yemeni people. This involvement implicates all of us, unless we fight back and take a stand for unitary Cyprus, free from foreign military presence.
The people of Cyprus and all peace-waging people of the world demand all NATO bases out of Cyprus. An end to the strikes of Yemen and an end to the Zionist occupation of Palestine. Liberate Cyprus, free Palestine, resist US-led war.
Okay.
Well, yeah. The first thing I have to say about that is the irony is we're not even a NATO member. We're not actually even a NATO member. That's what's most bizarre about it. The fact that the island is being used as a NATO base, but we're not a NATO member. But yeah, just a little brief history. So first of all, based on our little conversation and how we began speaking, it's very important to note there isn't a Greek Cyprus and a Turkish Cyprus. So there's a Republic of Cyprus and there's the occupied Northern Territory, which was occupied in 1974 following the war, the invasion, well, there was a coup, and then there was invasion by Turkey. And but to go a bit before that, obviously Cyprus was colonized by the British, as many nations within that region were. They were colonized by the British. And during our fight for national liberation, there was many pan-Cypriot movements at the time, particularly from the left, who were calling for a national liberation movement as an independent state. But the British began using these sort of reductive terms and labeling people within the community that had different religious backgrounds, giving them different epithets and sort of capitalizing on that in order to create a more divisive, in order to divide the community, hence the divide and rule narrative, the divide and rule argument that was made in the video that you've just shown. And in 1960, there was a lot of upheaval for our national liberation movement. In 1959, there was a meeting between the Greek side and the Turk, well, the Greece and Turkey, when I say Greek side, Greek and Turkey, and the British in Zurich, and they basically drew up the plans of how they were going to give Cyprus their independence. We were never really given our independence. The idea was that the Treaty of Guarantees was going to give a permanent base for Greece, military base in Greece and Turkey and the British. And the idea was that they could intervene militarily whenever they thought it was necessary in order to prevent any sort of escalation between the different communities. So what is perceived, for example, as Greek Cypriot or Turkish Cypriot, we're all Cypriots just divided along religious lines, like an ethno-religious divide, like I said, as a result of British colonialism. And so in 1960, when we gained our independence was conditioned on essentially having Turkey have a right to intervene whenever they thought it was necessary, Greece having a right to intervene whenever it was necessary. And what the British got out of that was about 4% of our land, which is where the British bases are at the moment. And until today, the British bases have essentially been, well, another thing I think it's important to say here is that it was conditional. So our national liberation was contingent to providing these bases, which is in of itself a violation of our right to self-determination, because no colonial empire should ever have to condition anybody for their right to their own freedom. But we were conditioned. So if we were to be free, we as a state and exist as a state, although a monkey state in many ways, we had to allow for the British bases to exist, and also essentially allow two other nation states, Turkey and Greece, to intervene whenever they wanted. And so that's the history of the bases in Cyprus. And then since, the British bases have been used systematically to wage war, intelligence surveillance in the region all the way, I mean, even further out of the region, all the way down to Africa. Due to the intercommunal conflicts that arose as a result of the divide and rule policies of the British colonial empire, there was essentially a coup, which was actually orchestrated by Greece in 1974, to overthrow the president at the time of Cyprus. And within 5 days after the coup, obviously Turkey got involved because they had the right to get involved to protect the Muslim community of Cyprus. And that was the first invasion. There were supposed to be a ceasefire period of a month where there's supposed to be some sort of negotiations to bring about peace. That didn't happen. And eventually there was a second invasion and they occupied the northern territory permanently tried to essentially annex it or declare it as an independent state. But we have been constantly, since 1974 until today, trying to find a one-state solution where basically the island will be unified under one singular state, that is the Republic of Cyprus. So there's no Greek Cyprus or Turkish Cyprus, it's just the Republic and then the occupied territories. Hopefully that gives like a brief little overview.
Yeah, and before we move on, you're looking for a one-state solution because perhaps two-state solutions aren't really tenable.
Yeah, we're looking for a one-state solution, although now if you were to come to Cyprus, like de facto, it would look like we're functioning in a two-state situation because obviously there is the northern territories, the Northern Republic, the Turkish Northern Republic of Cyprus, and they do have their own sense of government and they are functioning within the realm of a state. And I think what's important to understand here as well is that the idea is a one-state solution, but it also depends on who's in power. So for example, right now in the Turkish-occupied north, Tatar, who is actually in power at the moment, he is calling for a two-state solution, whereas in the south we're calling for a one-state solution. The reason he's calling for a two-state solution is because of other failed negotiations in the past. And I actually understand the reasons he has given for that. But a two-state solution, it's complicated because it would essentially mean it would complicate everything with regards to the right of return, the refugees, and how we were to go about that as well. So ideally, we want to actually just restore the country as a singular unit, and everybody sort of returns homes and lives as a basically as we would have prior to 1974.
Yeah, you know, on a superficial level, it seems somewhat reminiscent of the one versus two state solution in Palestine, in a very superficial level. But yeah, with the centerpiece being the right of return for displaced people.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that being established, the strategic importance in the Eastern Mediterranean, obviously, like, it's in sortie range of Yemen. So fighter craft from, you know, the British base can basically fly into the Gulf of Aden, which means anything, any location from which anyone can threaten traffic through the Suez Canal, they have there. It's in within sortie range of NATO aircraft. But right now, it's breaking in Israeli media. Why is Israel buying an entire permanent port in Larnaca, Cyprus? And this may have been in the works for a while now, but it's only just surfacing in conjunction, seemingly in terms of optics, with talk of a temporary aid port in Gaza.
Exactly. And this is the idea as well, isn't it? I mean, Biden came out and essentially said, all right, this is a temporary port. It's going to be constructed within this period of 60 days, and it's only going to be temporary, right? So if it's a temporary port, why is Israel buying out, and they're cashing out something like $150 million to buy a port in Larnaca, Cyprus, in order to quote, according to their, this is Israeli media outlets, right? They basically are stating that the reason they're doing that, one of the reasons, is allegedly to control the aid that's going into Gaza. And the question is, well, if we're going to go within the realm of the excuses that they're giving, right, let's just keep it within that context, why would you buy $150 million worth of a port, which is obviously rather permanent and a huge investment, for something that's supposed to be allegedly temporary? It doesn't actually make any sense. So what this is suggestive of is that obviously there's something more concrete occurring here, and perhaps the temporary pier that's going to be built in Gaza is not as temporary at all. And what I was going to say is that if anything, what it's starting to look like is that the temporary pier that they're building, and if you go back to the 23rd, I think, of September, when Netanyahu was giving a speech at the United Nations, and he had basically shown the map of the new Middle East and the trade routes that he basically wanted to develop, you see it essentially going through Israel, going through Gaza. And the idea was, and if you go back as well to the East Med pipeline, to go through Cyprus and see a pathway from Cyprus into Crete and then into Europe. So right now, this humanitarian corridor that they're establishing alongside the port that they want to buy is increasingly looking as though they're actually trying to cement the East Med pipeline, which, interestingly, until a year ago, or actually relatively recently, was kind of at a dead end in many ways.
Right. And before we go into the East Med pipeline, I would just like to point out one thing about establishing a port in Cyprus to oversee aid. The World Central Kitchen ship Open Arms was inspected in Larnaca by Israeli officials and then sent along and basically is en route to Gaza, apparently, right now, according to recent reporting. But that whole process did not require Israel owning a port there. So,
no, it didn't. Exactly. That's another great point. For this process, I guess they need the port for whatever reason. And they actually did a test run, I think, at some point in October, because actually Cyprus was they were advocating from pretty early on to open a humanitarian corridor into Gaza. And there was a trial a trial shipping, let's just say, of aid between Cyprus and Egypt. That's just a test trial. And that also went by just fine. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. And so we're talking about the East Med gas pipeline. And just in broad strokes, could you basically describe what that whole plan was for the audience?
Yeah, so basically, I mean, within the last 10 to 15, not 10, longer than that, 15 to 20 years, because I think the gas reserves in the Ghaza Marine have been discovered around 20 years ago. But generally, within the Levantine Basin, they had discovered a certain level of gas reserves. And over the course of the last 10 years, there have been discussions with regards to building the East Med pipeline. But the fundamental problems, parenthesis here, the East Med pipeline agreements were actually made between Egypt, Israel, Cyprus, and Greece. But one of the fundamental issues about the pipeline, even according to Victoria Nuland, who had actually visited Cyprus in April of 2022, was that it wasn't economically viable. It was far too expensive for the amount that you're going to be basically extracting. So from an investment return, an energy return investment ratio, it wasn't considered worthwhile. And in fact, at one point, the United States, who was backing the East Med pipeline, had actually pulled out. And one of the other issues beyond the economic element is also the political element. I mean, if you look at the area there, there are so many small countries that are claiming obviously access to the reserves, and each one of these countries has internalized conflicts. Obviously you have Israel, then you have the fact that Israel is obviously colonizing Palestine, and obviously Palestinians' rights and access to their own reserves, and how you would obviously have to deal with it from the perspective of finding a resolution for the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Then there's Cyprus, you have occupied territory in Cyprus. We have the same issue as well with regards to extracting our gas reserves. There was tensions between Cyprus and Turkey. Then there was tension between Turkey and Greece. Then there was tension between Lebanon and Israel. So the entire political atmosphere surrounding the pipeline as well made it very difficult to begin to extract. And that's one of the reasons the United States had initially pulled out. And it's not until recently, when now even the European Union has come out, and like in November, 28th of November this year, it was reported that it's now become one of the top on the list of priorities for the United, for the EU. And that has everything to do, obviously, with the economic crisis that the European Union is facing, the war in Ukraine, the sanctions on Russia, and obviously newfound interest in the region.
Yeah. And so I think the amount of internalized conflicts that one has to juggle when kind of trying to consider what's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean right now is kind of, it's kind of a mind bender, because then you also have the secondary, another internalized conflict in the Sinai Peninsula, especially with the refugees. You know, Egypt has been fighting a low intensity conflict with, a Bedouin insurgency as well. And so that's another added pressure to accepting refugees into the region, the buffer zone that we touched on earlier. So the East Med pipeline, yeah, back on the list of priorities. Also, people started catching on to what was going on when the Times of Israel in early November put out that British Petroleum had been awarded exploration rights into the Gaza Marine Basin. And I think that was kind of the lever that opened everybody's awareness, you know, because most people didn't even have any idea what was going on with Israel-Palestine before October 7th. But that was one of the articles where they thought, oh, this could be resource-driven. And so if we look at the Gaza Marine Basin here, we have EEZs, which are exclusive economic zones that are supposed to belong to essentially like a certain country and their mineral rights. And so we've got this kind of map that's going to be, I don't know, it looks like a bureaucratic nightmare, but we have.
No. And you know, actually, I think it was the end of October, right? I think the 29th of October as well, when the licenses came through and Israel issued something like licenses to six international organizations, Israeli and other international organizations, to basically extract gas reserves, and some of them are actually zones G, which, as we can see, supposed to be disputed belonging to the Palestinians, belonging to Gaza. So they're basically extracted, or they've given the licenses for companies to start extracting. So yeah, zones G and H are actually Palestinian exclusive economic zones.
Yeah, I mean, yep, H and E, that's what it looks like as well. Yeah, so I think Israel's been trying to kind of end run Palestinian rights over their mineral reserves for quite a long time. But I've been, you can find documentaries dating back 10 years on Al Jazeera about how Israel are on the mainland extracting Palestinian oil as well. So
the thing is as well, when it comes to the because there's a lot of dispute as well. A lot of people come into the conversation saying, well, I mean, there isn't that much gas and it is going to be costly. And I think one of the reasons that the Gaza Marine is so it's so important right now is because out of all the gas reserves in the entire region, because it's so close to the coast, it's actually far easier and far cheaper to actually extract right now. And that would be a huge, huge alleviation of the economic turmoil, let's just say, for the European Union. That's why the Gaza Marine as well is so zoned in at the moment.
Right. Also, there's a collaboration with Egypt that some people will probably find troubling because, people are expecting Egypt to do everything they can to help the Palestinian cause. Like, people are like, why aren't they taking refugees? And there are many facets to the refugee situation, and especially with the impending Rafah assault, the Israel's basic military doctrine is to pressure the civilian population in order to get political concessions from the associated government. So I personally see the threat of a Rafah assault as a lever in which to put pressure on the Egyptian government to accept displaced people. But I keep telling people Egypt has their own problems. Again, low intensity conflict. The Bedouin do not want refugees on the Sinai. The Egyptian government does not want a flare up of hostilities. Also, their economy is not in the best shape. But we wanted to talk about Egypt's role in the Gaza genocide and occupation of Palestine.
That I think it's one of the points that you just made, though, because our economic situation is so dire, that is what the Western elites, so the Western imperialist elites, through their financial capitalist control over the region, are going to try to essentially provoke or use as coercion to get Egypt into accepting something, which is, say, an influx possibly of refugees or displaced people, which they otherwise wouldn't have had their circumstances been different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this US-UK bombing of Yemen and the Red Sea is what caused the Suez Canal to effectively shut down. And from a military perspective, I'm talking to people on the ground in Yemen, and I also understand how US targeting works. They're not really hitting anything. This is just a smoke and light show. The Houthis have been bombed by the Saudis, which is essentially US fighter planes with Saudi fighter pilots in the same bombs we use, and the same targeting procedures we use, trying to bomb them into oblivion. It didn't work. But, you know, the U.S. is intentionally hitting decoy missiles that the Houthis are laying out, and they're hitting empty warehouses. And so, yeah, maybe you can talk more about the Suez Canal. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. So you've got to ask yourself, because even Biden came out, right? I remember when they asked in the infamous clip, you know, are you bombing, you know, are the bombs helping? He's like, well, no, but we're going to continue doing it. So you've got to ask yourself, okay, logically, you've got to ideologize these things. Why is the United States and the United Kingdom bombing Yemen, but not actually bombing anything, not achieving anything militarily? They're not actually helping restore peace in the Red Sea. In fact, they've obviously made it worse. We're seeing statistics come out, graphs come out, essentially, that the Suez Canal is basically completely closing down. And the only rational outcome you can come, like I'm coming to anyway, is that actually they want the Suez Canal to be essentially sort of shut down in order to strain Egypt, because Egypt is so dependent on the Suez Canal. Suez Canal is one of the most geostrategically important maritime trade routes right now. And given the fact that Egypt itself is the second most indebted nation to the IMF in the world after Argentina. And that's saying something as well. Look at the state of Argentina at the moment. I mean, the economy, the Egyptian economy just cannot simply be able to withstand the inflation that they've been hit with as a result of basically closing down the Suez Canal. I think it was I was reading some of the stats coming out, and even in February, they went up by, I think their inflation hit up by 35.7%. That was just in February. And now that's significantly increased as well because of the free flowing of the currency. That was one of the terms for the IMF to essentially even give them the loan. But what does this mean? Their inflation is sky high. They're running out of foreign currency reserves, which means that their currencies depreciate even further because obviously when you're indebted, usually in the dollar, obviously, the dollarization of the world, in order to purchase dollars, in order to have access to dollars, you need to be able to purchase dollars so that you can pay off your debt, and they have a lack of. So their economy is in a very volatile state. And the situation in the Suez Canal, which has been aggravated by the United States and by the United Kingdom, is actually costing Egypt significantly. So placing Egypt in a situation now economically where they can basically coerce them into aiding Israel's genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, because this is what it's essentially looking like. Because their inflation is sky high, their economy is failing, and now all of a sudden the IMF has come in, gave them $8 billion in loans. The World Bank now has also stated within the last 3 days, they're also going to give them $3 billion. And even the European Union has come in and essentially said they're going to give them migrant support loans in the form of $5 billion migrant support loans. So there's a huge influx of money coming in now under the condition, supposedly the free flowing of their currency as well, but at a particular point where their economy is being very hard hit.
Yeah. And so since a lot of people are getting like kind of a practical crash course in international relations since this thing kicked off, just in case you're not tracking, the IMF is the International Monetary Fund, which is a major financial agency of the United Nations and an international financial institution funded by 190 member countries, with the headquarters, of course, in Washington, D.C. And we have talked, we often say that the IMF is like debt colonialism.
It is debt colonialism, exactly. Because once any particular nation state starts borrowing from the IMF and they're indebted to the dollar, it becomes a vicious cycle, essentially, of currency depreciation. their exports become dirt cheap, which means that they're constantly in a state of deficit and constantly trying to pay back a debt that they never will. And what happens is that the vast majority of these loans are always conditional. And what happens from that point on is that the IMF then essentially controls what is supposed to be government institutions, taxation, welfare is essentially controlled by the IMF through their conditioning. So it's a form of financial capitalist imperialism, colonialism.
Yeah, and you wrote this note, the IMF loan, World Bank loan, EU loans, and the UAE, $34 billion worth of investments all within 3 weeks.
Yeah, all within 3 weeks. Because 3 weeks ago, the 23rd of February, the UAE basically just invested $34 billion into Egypt, supposedly for business development along the coast of Egypt. And that was actually one of when the UAE had invested this money into Egypt, that became a stepping stone for the IMF as well to come in and feel more secure in giving the Egypt an even greater loan. So it really begs the question, there's been an influx of money right now in Egypt within 2 weeks from World Bank, International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and the UAE in such large bulks. It really brings the question, to what extent are these parties, let's say, what is their actual agenda in bringing all this money into Egypt, and how is this going to affect the assault on Rafah? And this would include the UAE and the Arab states, which don't really get that much of a, there isn't so much of a discussion as to their involvement.
Right. And a lot of people who are in the Middle East right now do not want to discuss their involvement because, you know, visas could get revoked, denied, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that can happen. So
I was even going to say, speaking about the Suez Canal, this is a little random side note, to understand the significance of the Suez Canal, one of the reasons why the British refused to leave Cyprus, I mean, actually up until the 1950s, yes, they colonized Cyprus, but it wasn't so strategically as important to them. I mean, initially, they thought it was very important, but then they were more focused on their control of the Suez Canal. And obviously, after the 1952 revolution in Egypt and the rise of Nasser, and then they eventually lost the Suez Canal in 1956, the headquarters in 1954 actually moved to Cyprus. And then from that point on, the Prime Minister of the UK said they will never, ever leave Cyprus because they will assert control over the Suez Canal. That is how geostrategically important the Suez Canal is. And we're seeing it play out right now.
Right. And then, of course, we've got the British bases in Cyprus as well. And the Cypriot states are, I imagine they're never informed on how the bases are used. Nothing new there.
And that's the thing as well with that. So look, the bases have been used to inflict chaos within the region. I mean, they were used during the Gulf War. They were used during the Iraq War between 2003 to 2011. I mean, I remember I grew up in Larnaca. That's where I'm from. And my house is a good 50-minute walk away from these ports that they're going to be shipping off from. And you can hear, I mean, we could hear, I remember going to school and we would be able to hear all the military jets, planes, the American planes, as well as the British, as they were essentially bombing Iraq, attacking Syria. Right now, they're bombing Yemen from the Cypriot bases again. And the Cypriot government is never informed as to any of this. And according to Declassified UK, I mean, they have been flying out up to 50, at least 50 surveillance missions from the British bases to Gaza. They're flying over Gaza. They're not informing us as to what the reason is. Some of the arguments given by the British states is, oh, we're helping surveillance because there's two British hostages. 50 military planes over Gaza within a month and a half for surveillance for two hostages. And we all know how advanced the Israeli surveillance system is. Let's put it that way. I don't really think you need 50 military planes flying from Cyprus to Gaza consistently. And so, Cyprus has been consistently being used to monitor the region, surveillance the region, bomb the region, and we're never told or given any heads up. And it actually has placed Cyprus in a situation where I think it was a British MP who was saying we could be the targets of any retaliatory attack. And we've had that actually a few years ago because of the conflict in Syria and because obviously Turkey was involved in the conflict in Syria and they were using the northern part, the occupied territories of Cyprus. We had a missile hit Cyprus in 2018. I was still there from Syria. And a lot of the speculation at the time was to basically send a warning to Turkey. And this is the thing. We have all these powers, whether it's Turkey through the occupied north or Britain through its bases, that are just doing whatever they want with our territory and exposing our nation state to risks. And we don't even have a say.
Now, and you definitely don't have a say for whatever Israeli intelligence operations are going on as well.
Mm-hmm. Again, it was interesting because, again, it was in 2019, again, in my city, in Larnaca, a lot of things happened in Larnaca. There was a big scandal because basically there was a van with 9 million surveillance spy tech that was essentially just situated in the city and using this very high profile tech to spy on anyone and everyone, really. And there were even this was actually conducted by a former Israeli veteran, former Israeli intelligence. And he was even boasting about it in Forbes magazine. And that's when it became knowledge in Cyprus that this was happening within our streets, and we were completely clueless about it. And in many ways, Cyprus has become the breeding ground for Mossad intelligence, NATO intelligence, and we're just passive observers. And just a one side note I would like to make here, somebody that I really enjoy watching, Professor Said Marandi, he's like an Iranian specialist and geopolitical analyst that I really enjoy. He was saying, I mean, if there's any sort of attack on Iranian territory or any hostility within Iranian territory, they will retaliate towards any location that they feel is hostile. Cyprus would fall into that category, and therefore the Cypriot population is at risk, and we don't even have a say.
Yeah, Syed Marandi, Iranian expert. I'll post his link in the description if you want to check him out further. It's very clear that in every way Cyprus is a colony without self-determination, split in multiple different ways. We were also talking about how Cyprus sees a lot of just Israeli citizens coming in, perhaps an influx since the beginning of the war. And before, I'm sure there's plenty of real estate development. I know there are some EDM festivals in Cyprus, so I'm sure they come for those, because anytime there's an EDM festival, those dudes show up.
The thing is as well, I mean, just a little history there as well, which I think is interesting, and I think it really relates to what's going on now in Palestine as well, is that the birth of Zionism, Fedor Herzl didn't actually believe that all of Palestine was enough for the Israeli state to establish Israel. And that's all of Palestine. That would include Gaza, the West Bank. It was never supposed to be enough. They actually wanted Cyprus, parts of Jordan, Sinai, parts of Lebanon, and even Rhodes Island from Greece to actually constitute as what he called Greater Palestine, to become Greater Israel. And three times in our history, Herzl wanted Cyprus to establish Israel. And there was a plan which included a population transfer of the native indigenous population of Cyprus and to bring in and establish Israel. And so there is a history there of Israel feeling of Zionist idea, like a Zionist sort of claims to Cyprus. And in the last 2-3 years, there's been this rise of interest in restoring that. I mean, I think the Jerusalem Post was basically discussing things, how Cyprus is the Jewish colony or Israel 2.0. And then within 2 years, we've seen tens of thousands of Israelis. And they're also purchasing land in the occupied north, which is illegal because it belongs to refugees. So, for example, my family, who are refugees displaced from the north, they're purchasing that land, which make it very difficult, especially when we're speaking about a right to return. And part of this is the reason they're doing this is to geostrategically have a hold on the region no matter what, which would also go back to why they're buying the port, right? Mm-hmm. It's about strategically placing themselves there. I mean, there was a piece that I read published by the University of Haifa, I think, about how Cyprus, this was in 2007, is the springboard to the Aliyah, which is sort of the idea of the Holy Land. So securing themselves in Cyprus as well is very important. And since October 7th, yeah, there's been a huge influx. I mean, that was already happening. It's just amplified. And it all boils down to the geostrategic importance of the region and retaining their control even over Palestine through Cyprus as well.
Yeah, and speaking of Cyprus, I'm kind of a classical and medieval history nerd. So Cyprus, this is nothing new for Cyprus. It's always been hugely strategically important, especially when we talk about other past colonial projects in that region, like, I don't know, the Crusader Kingdom. When they retook Jerusalem, they built what, Colossi Castle on Cyprus by the Order of the Knights Hospitaller. It's always been very important for the control of the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yeah, it's always been very important for the control of the Eastern Mediterranean, which is why it was, yeah, we've been essentially conquered by everyone. We've never been allowed to live as a autonomous group of peoples, not even now. And that's that's the sad reality of it. Because, and I think what people need to understand is that the Eastern Mediterranean is, and not just the Eastern Mediterranean, but the entire sort of part of Western Asia, it's so important because of resources, but also because of maritime, the maritime trade. They have the most significant and vital trade routes. And when you can control them, you can control the world economy. And economic control and economic warfare is a form of imperialism, and it's another form of hard power, especially in the in the frame of imperialism.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I was first kind of learning about military science, when we talked about hard power, we thought it would just was about militaries and stuff. No, economics is just you can express some serious violence through economic warfare as well.
I mean, if you think about it, look what happened to Iraq in the 90s. I mean, when they sanctioned Iraq in the 90s, it brought about the death of 500,000 children. 500,000 children in the space of 10 years because of the economic sanctions, which is why actually under international law, and my international law coming in handy, it's actually considered to be illegal. It's a violation of the very basic principles of international humanitarian law because of the damage that it inflicts on a civilian population. You can even be, it basically can constitute a form of collective punishment.
Yeah. And circling back to Yemen, reclassifying them as a terrorist organization. I mean, they didn't get hit again with the FTO, the foreign terrorist organization, but they did get hit with the terrorist group designation, which still is, in my opinion, a form of collective punishment for all of Yemen because it affects how they can get aid and another, how they can conduct diplomatic relations as well. So
100%. And the thing is as well is that there's always this misconception in the media that the Houthis are, they're actually called Ansar Allah, but the West mm-hmm. called them the Houthis. Yeah. Ansar Allah, they are essentially the governing force of Yemen. They're essentially the government of Yemen. I mean, they control 80% of the population in the south, which is where the majority of the people live. And there was a revolution. They're there by legitimate right. They're not some sort of, as some say, ragtag terrorist group that are just roaming around free in Yemen. So an attack on the Houthis is an attack on the entire Yemenese people because they are their government.
Right. And again, if I keep bringing this up, if you challenge Western imperialist interests like freedom of navigation, maritime commerce, you're going to get hit with a terrorist designation. And, you know.
But that's always been that's part of the ploy, isn't it? I mean, the moment you have something they want, they will find a way to villainize you so as to justify attack. To justify whether it's military intervention, economic warfare, that is the basic premise. I mean, look at the war on terror, I mean, the Iraq war, I mean, the whole weapons of mass destruction, and it was going to be a direct threat to the United States, and millions of people were killed. And up until today, I mean, something that a lot of people don't understand is that Iraq is still occupied, essentially. I mean, they're essentially under the control of the United States. They haven't officially left. And even when Iraq, the governing power, had voted to leave, or they wanted the U.S. military to leave, I think Trump in 2020 said that he would sanction them. Oh, no, not sanction them. What it actually said is, you have to pay us back for the military bases that we've spent to build all the bases. It's like, but nobody, like, you built the bases and you want us to pay for your colonialism? Like, what?
I mean, he that's just Trump wanting everyone to pay for everything that, you know, we do. He also wants Mexico to pay for the border wall. Okay. He just said, yeah, so.
But I mean, it's something important as well. Like, there isn't that much of a difference between, Trump or Biden at this point. That's another thing I think people need to understand. It's all imperialism at the end of the day. They're all looking at their own self-interest. People shouldn't be deceived by things. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, I mean, when you look at even when it comes to Palestine, right, Trump had actually, he was the one that moved the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, essentially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is an annexed territory of Palestine, essentially. It's mm-hmm. occupied Palestinian territory. Biden came into power, did he reverse that? Absolutely not. It's just a continuation of the same policies, you know what I mean? And people need to become aware of that, especially now because it's election year, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is where all the warts come out and all the obfuscating rhetoric happens. Like, coming back, starting from the beginning, humanitarian aid corridor. Yeah, or it's an East Med pipeline, or, you know, it's a supplement to, you know, the Mumbai to Europe New Silk Road plan they have, like, they
want to enact. I was actually going to bring that up. I wanted to ask your opinion on this, actually. The only thing that perplexes me, sort of Saudi Arabia's role, because with the East Med pipeline, and I think the plans that Netanyahu had prior to October 7th, right, it was to establish sort of a trade route within the context of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Now, Saudi Arabia has come out and said, oh, we're not going to normalize. Normalization with Israel is contingent to the establishment of a Palestinian state. But with the humanitarian corridor that we're seeing being developed, the port that they're trying to buy in Cyprus, which clearly has a strategic objective here, like I said, we are seeing essentially the East Med pipeline being established, this sort of trade route. My question is, like, something I'm pondering on, will Saudi Arabia in a way contribute to this? Because we know that they pay lip service, but because the other aspect is that Saudi Arabia is also part of BRICS and they are part of the BRI. So,
yeah, I mean, they have some serious split loyalties going on. First of I don't think they'll ever, like, go hardline with Israel because, and this is the same thing we see with a lot of Arab leader governments. It's they're scared of another Arab Spring. And one of Israel's greatest insurance policies is that they export all the spyware so that governments can spy on their own citizens. And they don't, because they're scared of their own citizens. So, yeah, I think that's just one of the multifaceted insurance approaches that Israel has cultivated with Arab governments throughout the region. So it's a really complicated issue, but it's just lip service from the Gulf states. First of all, yeah, they're part of BRICS, but I'm not convinced that they want to be recognized as part of the global South. You know, I think they want a seat at the Western imperialist table, and they're scared of their own people. So yeah, they say, yes, we're not going to do this until a two-state solution is reached. But, you know, they'll probably, when things settle down after a ceasefire has happened and a few months pass, they'll be like, well, as long as the process is in place, you know, we can start the normalization process again, which we were going to do before October 7th. So it's kind of like election rhetoric for a country that doesn't have elections. So
for the country, that's true. Yeah. Election, exactly. Yeah, good point. That's the thing. It's something that's just I keep pondering on as well myself, because it's a very complex situation and what's happening with the Arab states. Because even before October 7th, with the whole normalization, there was another issue. Let's be very clear. The Arab states do not care about the leaders, not the people. The leaders do not care about the Palestinian cause. I mean, yeah, this is a fact.
That's an important qualification, and it's absolutely true.
They don't care. But one of the issues as well with any possible agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia was the issue of security and nuclear power. And I think this was also up for contestation in Israel, because I think I was reading a piece by Haaretz, and they made a good point when they actually said that if Netanyahu had made these agreements with Saudi Arabia, he would be the man known as starting the nuclear arms race in the Middle East, because a lot of Israelis wouldn't feel comfortable, even if there was a peace agreement between the two and normalization, to have Saudi Arabia have the nuclear capabilities, essentially. So, I don't know. And also Saudi Arabia is trying to play, I mean, they're trying to integrate further now with China, and they are trying to integrate further trade-wise with Russia, so they say. So that's why I don't understand, like, this is what how I feel like they're trying to play both sides, because I do agree with you. I think that once a ceasefire comes through, I could see them trying to normalize with Israel, but that would then counter their negotiations with Iran and China, and particularly the BRICS. And I don't know how that's the one thing that I haven't managed to personally figure out.
Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of predictions that I made, a lot of people made that never came to fruition. I think, you know, a lot of times we go off precedent when trying to make any sort of like geopolitical analysis. We look for historical analogs and stuff, but we're really kind of in uncharted territory. I can't, but beyond like what's going on tactically on the ground, like this whole, I can't find any corollaries. It's kind of like uncharted territory in a lot of ways.
Because in many ways it's insanity. There's a lot of irrationality, yes, and a lot of desperation. Yeah. And this is the thing. I mean, even Israel, I can't say that Israel is being successful right now with its operation. I mean, okay, it's the not. Humanitarian corridor, it's obviously not. So there's a lot of desperation. And when there's so much desperation, desperate people do desperate things. And that's the insanity behind it. And I think that's why it makes it so difficult to predict what the outcome of all this is.
Yeah, and plus the idea of building an oil derrick off the coast of Gaza while Hamas still exists is really dumb, because guess what the Houthis just proved? Anti-ship missiles just work. You know, they work now. And what are you going to do? Put air defense systems on an oil derrick? Like, turn it into a military installation? Like, there's a lot of stuff that is not being thought out at all.
No, not at all.
It's a mess.
It's very
reactionary.
Impulsive. Yeah, reactionary. It's very impulsive. And as a result, it makes it very difficult to predict. I don't think this is long-term sustainable. I don't think that this is going to go. I think I was watching Scott Ryder. I don't know if you know him. He was saying that this could go on. Yeah, he was saying that this could go on for a year, like gradual. But I don't know. I don't see this sustainable for the next year, economically for Israel, politically for Israel. I mean, the whole place is in chaos internally and geopolitically for Israel right now. And also the entire Western establishment itself is being called to question. I mean, the illusion of democracy and the free world has essentially evaporated. I mean, for all those that were still maybe deceived by this mendacious diegesis, I think it's slowly now dissipating. That there's something fundamentally flawed about the way the Western institutions function.
Yeah. It seems like all these liberal, these global transnational institutions that were created out of the philosophy of liberalism, like the UN, are completely ineffective at stopping anything that the controllers of hard power want to do.
Yeah, and yeah. I don't know if you saw, I found it very entertaining when the Israeli UN representative gave a speech at the United Nations, I think 2 weeks ago, speaking about just how pertaining to Russia, you know, how Russia's holding the UN to hostage, and that the UN can't carry out its mission to prevent aggression. I just thought the irony of that coming from Israel, when they've got the United States doing just that for them, I thought was absolutely entertaining.
I'm not even sure they're aware of it.
I don't know. I mean, the level of gaslighting, if you watch that entire clip, it's like you're having a bit of a brain seizure. Like, what is he saying? And he was speaking about an invasion. And as well, the way the political elite are distorting international legal terminology, like invasion, right to self-defense, when there's no such right when you're dealing with a colonizing power or colonized people. And how the hell, I've never heard of a people that are colonized invading their colonizers within their own territory. Really, I mean, the sort of things that they come up with are insane. But they say these things, and I mean, I don't know whether they believe it or they just think everybody's absolutely moronic, so we're just all going to take that in.
Well, you know, I think the American education system has been a big failure. And, you know, a lot of people talk trash about how dumb Americans are, but I've been to Europe, man. It's everybody. And I think in the West, like a lot of people have fallen victim to their own propaganda. The propagandists believe their own propaganda. So I do think some of these people are absolutely cynical and maybe perhaps be functional sociopaths, but other people actually believe it. So,
I mean, they do say in doing financial crime, one of the things that we learn, especially when we're studying micro level theory, as to why certain individuals within a system are inclined to crime. And what we found was essentially that the capitalist system is essentially creates the perfect premise by which to reward sociopathic individuals, because they're the ones that tend to reach the highest in the rank. Like, most CEOs exhibit high levels of sociopathy.
Oh, that would be a cool return episode in the future, especially. I wonder if there's a correlation to politics as well, probably.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, there's no distinguishing element. There's no distinguishment between the private and the public sector, right? I mean, they're all interlinked. Yeah. Lobbying, or, you know, the revolving doors. I mean, people who worked for the Goldman Sachs working for the European Central Bank are now in the European Commission, for example, here, and making decisions for nation states at a bureaucratic level. But these people are private, you know, that they're high CEOs, for example, for private corporations that, you know, capitalized on economic crisis, for example. So you see, like, this is, it's all very nuanced. But
it's like you're a public servant, but like, how's that insider trading game going?
Exactly. Exactly. And then, so there's a lot of actors here at play. And even now with what's happening in Palestine, there's all these people that you have to take into consideration. And it's difficult because, like we said, we're also at a turning point in history, I always say. So things are very unpredictable right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to recap, the Gaza aid port, it's really not about aid. So if there's one takeaway.
What I find most disturbing about that as well, I just want to say, I mean, the entire fuss, we all know there's hundreds of trucks. How much, tons and tons of aid waiting to get in. It could easily just be let in, but apparently not. We're setting up this port that Israel is essentially going to control. They're again going to control the aid. So again, Israel's been given the control over Gaza's and the Palestinian people's food supply, aid, you know, medical supplies. What is the point? I mean, it doesn't even make sense.
I mean, I think this is what it is. Like, imperialists are going to imperial, right? And this is an election year. And so we need to maintain at least the veneer of a functional representative democracy. So people can be like, oh, okay, now we don't have to worry about Palestine anymore. Aid's going in. They say they're building a port. Okay, I can go back to spin class and yoga and get my latte. And that's good. So now I can vote for Joe Biden as a liberal. I can vote for Joe Biden.
It's a PR stunt to satisfy the masses into believing, okay, the problem's been resolved, while simultaneously probably robbing the Palestinians of their natural resources and ethnically cleansing them all in one.
It's like the trifecta. First, it continues to enable a genocide. It gets the votes for, you know, the uninformed population, and it makes the top 0.01% even richer.
Oh yeah, I mean they're the only ones that constantly are getting richer. We've had so many crises from 2008 until today. And their basically profits go up by 600% every time. The rest of us, the eradication of the middle class, you know, completely. The working class constantly struggling to get by, but they're making a lot of money. They're not seeing a crisis. We are.
All right. Well, I think we are just about at the end of our time. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope this was helpful in expanding the discourse about all of these like complex, dynamic geopolitical issues that we hope people are starting to kind of get a more intuitive understanding for, and like being able to see the patterns and the usual suspects with regards to this kind of stuff. Thank you so much, Alina, for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You're just getting onto social media to kind of create a platform for this kind of content. So I will link your Instagram In the description, and I know you post slides and stories about this, these kind of issues that are very informative in short form content. So we'll do that, and hope to see you again, and we will see y'all next time. Thanks for listening.